Dispatch, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under the radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth. Well, another week, another indictment against former President Donald Trump. The latest comes out of Georgia, but there's some Michigan connections going on here. And here with me to break it all down is reporter for the Michigan Advance, Anna Nichols. Anna, welcome to Mishmash.
Thank you for having me, Shayna.
So, Anna, you wrote in your piece, quote, "This indictment comes as the result of a large investigation into Trump and his allies' actions in Fulton County, Georgia, to cast seeds of doubt on the integrity of the last presidential election where Trump failed to be reelected to office." And as we said, this is an indictment coming out of Georgia. There has been other indictments against President Trump in other states. But how is Michigan sort of fitting into this particular one?
Yeah, I fully understand kind of the shock and amusement of to see Michigan, a state 800 miles away from Georgia, mentioned at length in this indictment. Most of it, as far as Michigan goes, is stuff Michigan residents might have already heard about, with the Fulton County grand jury putting intent behind the actions that already happened in public view. One of them that people probably definitely heard of, if not, they saw a retelling of it on SNL. Former mayor of New York and Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani's visit to Michigan to lawmakers at the end of 2020, where he and another attorney charged in this indictment brought a host of characters to the Michigan House Oversight Committee to importune lawmakers to appoint Trump-supporting presidential electors in an attempt to bypass the will of the people of Michigan, which chose Joe Biden by more than 150,000 votes.
The indictment also mentioned the meeting between then Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield and then Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, along with some other Michigan Republican lawmakers, and Donald Trump on November 20th, 2020 in the Oval Office. What is the indictment saying the significance is there?
That was another thing, is that was publicly known that there was a meeting, but to this day, we don't know much of what was said. And so the grand jury over in Fulton County again asserted the intent behind that meeting, which, like you said, was with then Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, where the grand jury accuses the group of attempting to subvert the election results and indulge in the throes of the conspiracy that there was mass fraud in Michigan's election.
Yeah, so it kind of sounds like the Fulton County prosecutor's office is essentially using stuff that happened in Michigan as building blocks for its case against Donald Trump. Is that a fair assessment?
I would agree. They make mention of, not to jump ahead, but to the fake elector conspiracies, which took place in several battleground states. They make mention of, I believe, all seven states.
What has been the reaction by Michigan politicians to this indictment and in general to what's been going on in the various legal troubles of Donald Trump?
I would say the narrative in terms of Republican leaders in Michigan still willing to back a Trump-led Republican Party, I would say the volume has been turned down. Not to say it's on mute, but I think that the Republican Party in Michigan, kind of illustrated by some of the surprising votes in our 2022 midterm election, the party itself is trying to still sort out what their priorities are going to be in terms of backing Trump.
You mentioned the so-called fake electors. Attorney General Dana Nessel has filed her own charges in regards to the 2020 election, not against Trump, but against that sort of slew of fake electors or so-called fake electors, people who were trying to put themselves forward to get the results overturned. Remind us about that case, and is there any update on that?
Yeah, so it's an interesting group of individuals where it's not people uninvolved in Michigan politics, it's large stakeholders and officials around the state. We have the mayor of Wyoming. We have the former Michigan Republican Party co-chair, Michon Madak, Michigan GOP National Councilwoman, Kathy Burden, who we found out in a previous court hearing, isn't a Michigan resident anymore due to some health complications. We have the Shelby Township trustee and clerk, Stanley Grote, among other players around Michigan. Among social media postings and things that have just been said on behalf of attorneys, there's been an assortment of justifications, explanations given by different members of this cohort. Some say they were unaware what they were signing, that it more was filed to leave room for further edification of the election process due to the belief, the grand lie, that there was mass fraud.
And some of the electors are in court today. What is the status of their cases?
We're still in the early stages of the case. Some of the court dates for some of the members have been bumped back to later in the fall. So a lot is left to be seen on, you know, what a judge is going to think of some of these justifications.
Let's move on to the Inflation Reduction Act. It turned 1 year old this week, and Michigan Democrat leaders are really touting a lot of its successes, or what they say are successes. Anna, what is this act and why are the Democrats so amped up about it?
The Inflation Reduction Act, which was signed by Biden in 2022, outlines some environmental priorities, some incentives, especially where it pertains to electric vehicles, both in manufacturing and also tax stipends for those who make the transition to electric vehicles. It outlines caps on certain prescription drugs, notably insulin, which has a $35 cap on the monthly cost. There are going to be additional health caps put into place in 2025 under the IRA.
So what are Democrats saying they've really like succeeded with and the benefits of this act?
So Democrats are already saying that their constituents have saved hundreds, if not thousands of dollars in medical care costs. They're saying that there have been transitions within the state to meet the state's own goals of transitioning to electric vehicles that Whitmer has outlined.
Anna, you've been doing great work covering trans issues in the state and following up on this issue a lot. One of your most recent articles was on bills that could be introduced soon, making it easier for name changes. Can you tell us about what's going on there?
I initially was unaware that there was a different system in place for those who say are getting married and would like to change their name versus those who change their name for virtually any other reason, which under that umbrella includes all the trans, non-binary, or otherwise Michiganders in the state. So when you get married, as I'm sure you can attest, if you change your name, not that there's no cost to changing your name should you be married, but when you get married, it's also a much shorter process for which you alert the Social Security office, you get a new Social Security card for free, and then you take your documents, including the new Social Security card, to your local Secretary of State branch office, where the cost of changing a Michigan driver's license or state ID is also going to run you under about $20. Whereas if you change your name for virtually any other reason, including being trans or non-binary, or just changing your name because it doesn't suit you, and maybe you went by your middle name your whole life and you'd like to not have to sign a name that you never use on official documents, or have it on your driver's license, you go to court, which was surprising to me. The initial filing for petition for a name change runs around $200. And then you're subject to a bunch of other things like fingerprinting. And should you have any level of a criminal record, you also have to justify to a judge. You might have to hire legal representation to prove that you are not attempting fraud, which is automatically assumed under Michigan law. But additionally, you get fingerprinted. Those prints need to clear Michigan state records. They need to clear, they then get sent and need to clear the FBI's records. You also need to publish in a news outlet that the court determines for you the details and date of your name change hearing, so that if anyone wants to contest it, they can. Including those who simply have the same name as you. They have a right to contest your name change. to say, I don't think they should have that name.
So what would these bills do? How would they change the system?
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The bills in their final iteration have not been introduced yet, meaning we don't have bill language, but it essentially would eliminate automatic systems that people would automatically have to appear in court, they would automatically have to get fingerprinted, and they would automatically have to publish their name, sometimes their dead name that they don't use anymore, and, you know, can be emotionally hard to hear and see associated with you for all to see. The bills wouldn't necessarily get rid in all cases those processes, but it would make it so it's up to a judge's discretion.
So for people who are tracking how the state is handling sort of the influx of aggression that we have seen recently against trans people, how are things looking in Michigan right now for trans residents?
Like you said, we're kind of having an aggression and hate towards the trans community is kind of having a spotlight moment right now nationally, and Michigan is no outlier to this. Talking to the bill's sponsor, talking to stakeholders around the state who are interested in seeing these bills or similar legislation that would create equilibrium between systems for trans folks and other Michiganders, they're eager to see progress in legislation that would support trans Michiganders. For example, the passage of the expansion of ELCRA earlier this year. Michigan recently banned conversion therapy for minors, and lawmakers are currently looking at legislation that would add members of the LGBTQ community to the definition of hate crimes. They're eager and happy to see some of these bills progress, even get signed. But in talking with stakeholders, having to hear the vitriol from either the public or from floor speeches they don't necessarily like or agree with in the Capitol is really hard.
Finally, weapons detectors have been installed in the state Capitol building recently. Anna, what's going on here? Because I know that for as long as I know of, we haven't had any weapons detectors in the state capitol. You just walk in and go where you need to go. There's really hasn't even been any sort of check-in process at the state capitol. So what's going on there? What started this?
So consideration for added security measures or weapons ban in the capitol is not a new conversation. In looking at the history, for some of my coverage for the Second Amendment March at the state capitol, which has been going on for about a decade, I saw in previous news reports, previous members of the commission had been considering or saying that they were considering versions of a weapons ban. But what really hit it off was a armed protest against the COVID-19 lockdown precautions taken by Michigan by order of Governor Gretchen Whitmer. In 2020, at the end of April, there was an armed protest for which members of the protest entered the Capitol armed. They shouted obscenities at law enforcement within the Capitol. Senators say that the protesters yelled threats down at them from the Senate gallery. I was there. There was a lot of people. So the current conversation and now plans for a full weapons ban minus members of Capitol security. And now House and Senate lawmakers who have concealed carry permits, which was a surprise thrown at us this week by the Michigan Capitol Commission.
So they might exempt the lawmakers?
That's the plan. They voted on that this week. We had members of the public didn't know that that was going to happen. That was a surprise to, I'd say, the Capitol community this week at the Capitol Commission's meeting. Earlier, when I was covering the initial rough draft of the weapons ban, which is slated to start on Labor Day, or I guess the day after Labor Day, it didn't have a mention of this carve out for lawmakers who have concealed carry permits. This is new. This is sudden.
So the technology has been put into the office, the Capitol, and some of the office buildings, but they're not using them until after Labor Day when the weapons ban goes into place. Is that right?
Into the Capitol Commission. The timing of that is to coincide with the return of lawmakers from summer session. It also would coincide with students coming back to school. And according to the Capitol Commission, around 200,000 to 300,000 students come to the Capitol for field trips every year. And that doesn't even include the fact that you can walk into the Capitol, get a tour, walk around, perceive democracy around you.
How have people been reacting to having the weapons detectors in the Capitol? I know it's still pretty new, but have you noticed any frustrations, or is it already becoming sort of like business as usual?
I know that a part of this plan is to create signage to make the public aware this is happening. I have not seen a lot of public awareness that this is happening. They're testing out the system right now in the Capitol ahead of the actual ban. Weapons detection technology has been installed in the House business office building. So the technology has already shown up and it's operational, but I am looking to see if the Capitol Commission is going to solely rely on media reports to disseminate this information, or if the Capitol Commission itself will create more awareness that this is happening, because there's a lot to be known about this technology. I found out from looking at the label of it, it's a technology that's usually implemented in hospitals. And I had a conversation with someone who works in the House business office who was wondering if his medical device would put off the alarms, because 10% of Americans, according to the American Medical Association, will at some point in their life have an internal medical device. I have an external one I can take off, but I don't know how that's going to work on the day-to-day.
Anna Nichols is a reporter for the Michigan Advance. Anna, this has been such a joy to have you here today on Mishmash.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station. This episode was produced by myself, Shayna Roth, and Hearns Laguerre Jr. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. Our digital team is Dave Kim and Sophia Joswiak, with additional help from Jack Philbrandt. As always, if you listen to this show and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you really, really like this show, you can support WDET. Just go to WDET.org/give. Without your support, really, shows like this one and all of the great work that WDET does just would not be possible. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.